I am barely attuned yet to my surroundings. Still, as the ram lifts himself, folding his forelegs under his chest, I slide the gun up and sight behind his shoulder. The movement is smooth and steady, but perhaps the sun glints on the barrel, for in his descent he turns his head and sees me. His hooves touch ice with a click. His jaw stops in mid-motion. We gaze at each other. My pulse does not quicken. Evidently, it is not important to me that the ram die. He chews again, a single scythe of the jaws, and stops. In the clear silence of the morning, I find an obscure sentiment lurking at the edge of my consciousness. With the buck before me suspended in immobility, there seems to be time for all things, time even to turn my gaze inward and see what it is that has robbed the hunt of its savor. The sense that this has become no longer a morning's hunting, but an occasion on which either the proud ram bleeds to death on the ice or the old hunter misses his aim. That for the duration of this frozen moment, the stars are locked in a configuration in which events are not themselves, but stand for other things. Behind my paltry cover, I stand trying to shrug off this irritating and uncanny feeling. Till the buck wheels and with a whisk of his tail and a brief splash of hooves disappears into the tall reeds. I trudge on purposelessly for an hour before I turn back. Never before have I had the feeling of not living my own life on my own terms, I tell the girl, struggling to explain what happened. She is unsettled by talk like this, by the demand I seem to be making on her to respond.
I do not see, she says. She shakes her head. Didn't you want to shoot this buck?
For a long while, there is silence between us.
If you want to do something, you do it, she says very firmly.
She is making an effort to be clear, but perhaps she intends, if you had wanted to do it, you would have done it. In the makeshift language we share, there are no nuances. She has a fondness for facts, I note, for pragmatic dicta. She dislikes fancy, questions, speculations. We are an ill-matched couple. Perhaps that is how barbarian children are brought up, to live by rote, by the wisdom of the fathers as handed down. And you, I say, do you do whatever you want? I have a sense of letting go, of being carried dangerously far by the words. Are you here in bed with me because it is what you want? She lies naked, her oiled skin glowing a vegetal gold in the firelight. There are moments, I feel the onset of one now, when the desire I feel for her, usually so obscure, flickers into a shape I can recognize. My hand stirs, strokes her, fits itself to the contour of her breast. She does not answer my words, but I plunge on, embracing her tightly, speaking thick and muffled into her ear. Come, tell me why you are here.
Because there is nowhere else to go.
And why do I want you here? She wriggles in my grasp, clenches her hand into a fist between her chest and mine.
You want to talk all the time,
she complains. The simplicity of the moment is over. We separate and lie silent, side by side. What bird has the heart to sing in a thicket of thorns?
You should not go hunting if you do not enjoy it.
I shake my head. That is not the meaning of the story, but what is the use of arguing? I am like an incompetent schoolmaster, fishing about with my maiutic forceps when I ought to be filling her with the truth. She speaks.
You are always asking me that question. So I will now tell you. It was a fork, a kind of fork, with only two teeth. There were little knobs on the teeth to make them blunt. They put it in the coals till it was hot. Then they touched you with it to burn you. I saw the marks where they had burned people.
Is this the question I asked? I want to protest, but instead listen on, chilled.
They did not burn me. They said they would burn my eyes out, but they did not. The man brought it very close to my face and made me look at it. They held my eyelids open. But I had nothing to tell them. That was all. That was when the damage came. After that, I could not see properly anymore. There was a blur in the middle of everything I looked at. I could see only around the edges. It is difficult to explain. But now, it is getting better. The left eye is getting better. That is all.
I take her face between my hands and stare into the dead centers of her eyes, from which twin reflections of myself stare solemnly back. And this? I say, touching the worm-like seer in the corner.
That is nothing. That is where the iron touched me. It made a little burn. It is not sore.
She pushes my hands away. What do you feel towards the men who did this? She lies thinking a long time. Then she says,
I am tired of talking.
There are other times when I suffer fits of resentment against my bondage to the ritual of the oiling and rubbing, the drowsiness, the slump into oblivion. I cease to comprehend what pleasure I can ever have found in her obstinate, phlegmatic body, and even discover in myself stirrings of outrage. I become withdrawn, irritable. The girl turns her back and goes to sleep. In this moody state, I pay a visit one evening to the rooms on the second floor of the inn. As I climb the rickety outside stairway, a man I do not recognize hurries down past me, ducking his head. I knock at the second door along the corridor and enter. The room is just as I remember it. The bed neatly made. The shelf above it packed with trinkets and toys. Two candles burning. A glow of warmth coming from the great flue that runs along the wall. An odor of orange blossom in the air. The girl herself is occupied in front of the mirror. She gives a start at my entry, but rises, smiling to welcome me, and bolts the door. Nothing seems more natural than to seat her on the bed and begin to undress her. With little shrugs, she helps me bear her trim body.
How I have missed you,
she sighs. What a pleasure to be back, I whisper. And what a pleasure to be lied to so flatteringly. I embrace her, bury myself in her, lose myself in her soft, bird-like flurries. The body of the other one, closed, ponderous, sleeping in my bed in a faraway room, seems beyond comprehension. Occupied in these suave pleasures, I cannot imagine whatever drew me to that alien body. The girl in my arms flutters, pants, cries as she comes to a climax. Smiling with joy, sliding into a languorous half-sleep, it occurs to me that I cannot even recall the other one's face. She is incomplete, I say to myself. Though the thought begins to float away at once, I cling to it. I have a vision of her closed eyes and closed face, filming over with skin.
blank, like a fist beneath a black wig. The face grows out of the throat and out of the blank body beneath it, without aperture, without entry. I shudder with revulsion in the arms of my little bird woman, hug her to me. When later in the middle of the night I ease myself out of her arms, she whimpers but does not awaken. I dress in the dark, close the door behind me, grope my way down the stairs, hurry back home with snow crunching underfoot and an icy wind boring into my back. I light a candle and bend over the form to which it seems I am in a measure enslaved. Lightly, I trace the lines of her face with my fingertip. The clear jaw, the high cheekbones, the wide mouth. Lightly, I touch her eyelids. I am sure she is awake, though she gives no sign. I shut my eyes, breathe deeply to still my agitation, and concentrate wholly on seeing her through my blind fingertips. Is she pretty? The girl I have just left, the girl she may perhaps, I suddenly realize, smell on me, is very pretty. There is no question about that. The acuteness of my pleasure in her is sharpened by the elegance of her tiny body, its manners, its movements. But of this one, there is nothing I can say with certainty. There is no link I can define between her womanhood and my desire. I cannot even say for sure that I desire her. All this erotic behavior of mine is indirect. I prowl about her, touching her face, caressing her body, without entering her or finding the urge to do so. I have just come from the bed of a woman for whom, in the year I have known her, I have not for a moment had to interrogate my desire. To desire her has meant to enfold her and enter her, to pierce her surface, and stir the quiet of her interior into an ecstatic storm. Then to retreat, to subside, to wait for desire to reconstitute itself. But with this woman, it is as if there is no interior, only a surface across which I hunt back and forth, seeking entry. Is this how her torturers felt, hunting their secret, whatever they thought it was? For the first time, I feel a dry pity for them. How natural a mistake to believe that you can burn or tear or hack your way into the secret body of the other. The girl lies in my bed, but there is no good reason why it should be a bed. I behave in some ways like a lover. I undress her, I bathe her, I stroke her, I sleep beside her. But I might equally well tie her to a chair and beat her. It would be no less intimate. It is not that something is in the course of happening to me that happens to some men of a certain age. A downward progress from libertinage to vengeful actions of impotent yearning. If a change in my moral being were occurring, I would feel it. Nor would I have undertaken this evening's reassuring experiment. I am the same man I always was. But time has broken. Something has fallen in upon me from the sky, at random, from nowhere. This body in my bed, for which I am responsible, or so it seems. Otherwise, why do I keep it? For the time being, perhaps forever, I am simply bewildered. It seems all one whether I lie down beside her and fall asleep, or fold her in a sheet and bury her in the snow. Nevertheless, bending over her, touching my fingertips to her forehead, I am careful not to spill the wax. Whether she guesses where I have been, I cannot decide. But the next night, when I am lulled almost to sleep by the rhythm of the oiling and rubbing, I feel my hand stopped, held, guided down between her legs. For a while it rests against her sex. Then I shake more of the warm oil onto my fingers and begin to caress her. Quickly the tension gathers in her body. She arches and shudders and pushes my hand away. I continue to rub her body till I too relax and am overtaken with sleep. I experience no excitement during this, the most collaborative act we have yet undertaken. It brings me no closer to her, and seems to affect her as little. I search her face the next morning. It is blank. She dresses and stumbles down to her day in the kitchen. I am disquieted. What do I have to do to move you? These are the words I hear in my head in the subterranean murmur that has begun to take the place of conversation. Does no one move you? And with a shift of horror, I behold the answer that has been waiting all the time to offer itself to me, in the image of a face masked by two black, glassy insect eyes, from which there comes no reciprocal gaze, but only my doubled image cast back at me. I shake my head in a fury of disbelief. No, 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 I cry to myself. It is I who am seducing myself out of vanity into these meanings and correspondences. What depravity is it that is creeping upon me? I search for secrets and answers, no matter how bizarre, like an old woman reading tea leaves. There is nothing to link me with torturers, people who sit waiting like beetles in dark cellars. How can I believe that a bed is anything but a bed, a woman's body anything but a sight of joy? I must assert my distance from Colonel Joll. I will not suffer for his crimes. I begin to visit the girl at the inn regularly. There are moments during the day in my office behind the courtroom when my attention wanders and I drift into erotic reverie, grow hot and swollen with excitement, linger over her body like a moony, lustful youth. Then reluctantly I have to recall myself to the tedium of paperwork or walk over to the window and stare into the street. I remember how in the first years of my appointment here, I used to roam the obscurer quarters of the town toward dusk, shadowing my face in my cloak. How sometimes a restless wife leaning over the half door with the hearth fire gleaming behind her would answer my gaze without flinching. How I would fall into conversation with young girls promenading in twos and threes, buy them sherbet, then perhaps lead one away into the darkness to the old granary and a bed of sacks. If there was anything to be envied in a posting to the frontier, my friends told me, it was the easy morals of the oases, the long scented summer evenings, the complacent, slow-eyed women. For years, I wore the well-fed look of a prize boar. Later, that promiscuity modulated into more discreet relations with housekeepers and girls lodged sometimes upstairs in my rooms, but more often downstairs with the kitchen help, and into liaisons with girls at the inn. I found that I needed women less frequently. I spent more time on my work, my hobbies, my antiquarianism, my cartography. Not only that, there were unsettling occasions when in the middle of the sexual act, I felt myself losing my way, like a storyteller losing the thread of his story. I thought, with a shiver, of those figures of fun, fat old men whose overburdened hearts stop beating, who pass away in the arms of their loves with an apology on their lips, and have to be carried out and dumped in a dark alley to save the reputation of the house. The climax to the act itself became remote, puny, an oddity. Sometimes I drifted to a halt. Sometimes went mechanically through to the end. For weeks and months I would retire into celibacy. The old delight in the warmth and shapeliness of women's bodies did not desert me, but there was a new puzzlement. Did I really want to enter and claim possession of these beautiful creatures? Desire seemed to bring with it a pathos of distance and separation, which it was futile to deny. Nor could I always see why one part of my body, with its unreasonable cravings and false promises, should be heeded over any other as a channel of desire. Sometimes, my sex seemed to me another being entirely, a stupid animal living parasitically upon me, swelling and dwindling according to autonomous appetites, anchored to my flesh, with claws I could not detach. Why do I have to carry you about from woman to woman, I asked, simply because you were born without legs? Would it make any difference to you if you were rooted in a cat or a dog instead of in me? Yet at other times, and particularly in the last year, would the girl whose nickname at the inn is the Star, but whom I have always thought of as a bird, I felt again the power of the old sensual enchantment, swam out into her body, and was transported to the old limits of pleasure. So I thought, it is nothing but a matter of age, of cycles of desire and apathy in a body that is slowly cooling and dying. When I was young, the mere smell of a woman would arouse me. Now it is evidently only the sweetest, the youngest, the newest who have that power. One of these days it will be little boys. With some distaste, I looked forward to my last years in this bountiful oasis. 3 nights in succession now I visit her in her little room, bringing presents of kananga oil, sweets, and a jar of the smoked fish roe I know she loves to wolf down in private. When I embrace her, she closes her eyes, tremors of what seemed to be delight run through her. The friend who first recommended her to me spoke of her talents. It is all play-acting, of course, he said. But in her case, the difference is that she believes in the role she plays. For myself, I find I do not care. Captivated by her performance, I open my eyes in the midst of all the fluttering and shivering and moaning, then sink back into the dark river of my own pleasure. I spend 3 days of sensual languor, heavy-lidded, sleekly aroused, daydreaming. I return to my rooms after midnight and slip into bed, paying no attention to the obdurate form beside me. If I am woken in the morning by the sound of her preparations, I feign sleep till she is gone. Once, happening to pass the open kitchen door, I glance in. Through wraiths of steam, I see a stocky girl seated at a table preparing food. I know who that is, I think to myself with surprise. Nevertheless, the image that persists in my memory as I cross the yard is of the pile of green marrows on the table in front of her. Deliberately, I try to shift my mind's gaze from the marrows back to the hands that slice them, and from the hands to the face. I detect in myself a reluctance, a resistance. My regard remains dazedly fixed on the marrows, on the gleam of light on their wet skins. As if with a will of its own, it does not move. So I begin to face the truth of what I am trying to do. To obliterate the girl. I realized that if I took a pencil to sketch her face, I would not know where to start. Is she truly so featureless? With an effort, I concentrate my mind on her. I see a figure in a cap and heavy, shapeless coat standing unsteadily, bent forward, straddle-legged, supporting itself on sticks. How ugly! I say to myself. My mouth forms the ugly word. I am surprised by it, but I do not resist. She is ugly, ugly. I come back on the fourth night in a bad temper, thrashing about my rooms noisily, not caring who is woken. The evening has been a failure. The current of renewed desire is broken. I throw my boots on the floor and climb into bed, spoiling for a quarrel, longing for someone to blame, ashamed too of my childishness. What this woman beside me is doing in my life, I cannot comprehend. The thought of the strange ecstasies I have approached through the medium of her incomplete body fills me with a dry revulsion, as if I had spent nights copulating with a dummy of straw and leather. What could I ever have seen in her? I try to recall her as she was before the doctors of pain began their ministrations. It is impossible that my gaze did not pass over her as she sat with the other barbarian prisoners in the yard the day they were brought in. Somewhere in the honeycomb of my brain, I am convinced, the memory is lodged. But I am unable to bring it back. I can remember the woman with the baby, even the baby itself. I can remember every detail. The frayed edge of the woolen shawl, the patina of sweat under the wisps of fine baby hair. I can remember the bony hands of the man who died. I believe I can even, with an effort, recompose his face. But beside him, where the girl should be, there is a space, a blankness. I wake up in the night with the girl shaking me, and the echo of a thin moan still hanging in the air.
"You were shouting in your sleep," she says. "You woke me up."
"What was I shouting?" She mumbles something, turns her back on me. Later in the night, she wakes me again.
"You were shouting."
Thick-headed and confused, angry too, I try to look into myself, but see only a vortex, and at the heart of the vortex, oblivion.
"Is it a dream?"
she says. "I cannot remember any dream." Can it be that the dream of the hooded child building the snow castle has been coming back? If it has, surely the taste or the smell or the afterglow of the dream would linger with me. "There is something I must ask you," I say. "Do you remember when you were brought here, into the barracks yard for the first time? The guards made you all sit down. Where did you sit? Which way did you face?" Through the window I can see streaks of cloud racing across the face of the moon. Out of the darkness beside me, she speaks.
"They made us sit together in the shade. I was next to my father."
I summon up the image of her father. In silence, I try to recreate the heat, the dust, the smell of all those tired bodies. In the shade of the barracks wall, I seat the prisoners one by one, all that I can remember. I put together the woman with the baby, her woolen shawl, her bare breast. The baby wails, I hear the wail, it is too tired to drink. The mother, bedraggled, thirsty, looks at me, wondering if I can be appealed to. Next come two hazy forms, hazy but present. I know that with an effort half of memory, half of imagination, I can fill them out. Then comes the girl's father, his bony hands folded before him. His cap is tipped over his eyes. He does not look up. Now I turn to the space beside him. "On which side of your father were you sitting?"
"I sat to his right."
The space to the right of the man remains blank. Concentrating painfully, I see even the individual pebbles on the earth beside him and the texture of the wall behind. "Tell me what you were doing."
"Nothing. We were all very tired. We had walked since before dawn. We stopped to rest only once. We were tired and thirsty."
"Did you see me?"
"Yes, we all saw you."
I clasp my arms around my knees and concentrate. The space beside the man remains empty, but a faint sense of the presence of the girl, an aura begins to emerge. Now, I urge myself, now I will open my eyes, and she will be there. I open my eyes. In the dim light, I make out her shape beside me. With a rush of feeling, I stretch out to touch her hair, her face. There is no answering life. It is like caressing an urn or a ball, something which is all surface. I have been trying to remember you as you were before all this happened, I say. I find it difficult. It is a pity you can't tell me. I do not expect a denial, and it does not come. A detachment of new conscripts has arrived to take the places of men who have completed their 3-year spell on the frontier and are ready to leave for their homes. The detachment is led by a young officer who is to join the staff here. I invite him with 2 of his colleagues to dine with me at the inn. The evening goes well. The food is good, the drink plentiful. My guest has stories to tell about his journey, undertaken in a hard season, in a region wholly foreign to him. He lost 3 men on the way, he says. One left his tent in the night to answer a call of nature, and never returned. 2 more deserted, almost within sight of the oasis, slipping away to hide in the reeds. Troublemakers, he calls them, whom he was not sorry to be rid of. Still, do I not think their desertion was foolish? Very foolish, I reply. Has he any idea why they deserted? No, he says. They were fairly treated. Everyone was fairly treated. But then, of course, conscripts. He shrugs. They would have done better to desert earlier, I suggest. The country around here is inhospitable. They are dead men, if they have not found shelter by now. We speak of the barbarians. He is convinced, he says, that for part of the way he was trailed at a distance by barbarians. Are you sure they were barbarians? I ask. Who else could they have been? He replies. His colleagues concur. I like this young man's energy, his interest in the new sights of the frontier region. His achievement in bringing his men through in this dead season is commendable. When our companions plead the lateness of the hour and depart, I press him to stay. Past midnight, we sit talking and drinking. I hear the latest news from the capital, which I have not seen for so long. I tell him of some of the places I look back on with nostalgia. The pavilion gardens where musicians perform for the strolling crowds, and one's feet rustle through fallen autumn chestnut leaves. A bridge, I remember, from which one sees the reflection of the moon on the water that ripples around the pediments in the shape of a flower of paradise. The rumor going about brigade headquarters, he says, is that there will be a general offensive against the barbarians in the spring to push them back from the frontier into the mountains. I'm sorry to break off the train of reminiscing. I do not want to end the evening with a wrangle. Nevertheless, I respond, I'm sure it is only a rumor. They cannot seriously intend to do that. The people we call barbarians are nomads. They migrate between the lowlands and the uplands every year. That is their way of life. They will never permit themselves to be bottled up in the mountains. He looks at me oddly. For the first time this evening, I feel a barrier descend. The barrier between the military and the civilian. But surely, he says, if we are to be frank, that is what war is about, compelling a choice on someone who would not otherwise make it. He surveys me with the arrogant candor of a young graduate of the War College. I am sure that he is remembering the story, which must by now have gone the rounds, of how I withheld my cooperation from an officer of the Bureau. I think I know what he sees before him. A minor civilian administrator sunk after years in this backwater, in slothful native ways, outmoded in his thinking, ready to gamble the security of the Empire for a makeshift, insecure peace. He leans forward, wearing an air of deferential, boyish puzzlement. I'm more and more convinced he is playing with me. Tell me, sir, in confidence, he says, what are these barbarians dissatisfied about? What do they want from us? I ought to be cautious, but I am not. I ought to yawn, evade his question, end the evening. But I find myself rising to the bait. When will I learn to keep a cunning tongue? They want an end to the spread of settlements across their land. They want their land back, finally. They want to be free to move about with their flocks from pasture to pasture as they used to. It is not too late to put a stop to the lecture. Instead, I hear my voice rise in tone and abandon myself regretfully to the intoxication of anger. I will say nothing of the recent raids carried out on them, quite without justification, and followed by acts of wanton cruelty, since the security of the Empire was at stake, or so I am told. It will take years to patch up the damage done in those few days, but let that pass. Let me rather tell you what I find disheartening as an administrator, even in times of peace, even when border relations are good. There is a time in the year, you know, when the nomads visit us to trade. Well, go to any stall in the market during that time and see who gets short-weighted and cheated and shouted at and bullied. See who is forced to leave his womenfolk behind in the camp for fear they will be insulted by the soldiers. See who lies drunk in the gutter, and see who kicks him where he lies. It is this contempt for the barbarians, contempt which is shown by the meanest ostler or peasant farmer that I, as magistrate, have had to contend with for 20 years. How do you eradicate contempt? Especially when that contempt is founded on nothing more substantial than differences in table manners, variations in the structure of the eyelid. Shall I tell you what I sometimes wish? I wish that these barbarians would rise up and teach us a lesson, so that we would learn to respect them. We think of the country here as ours, part of our empire, our outpost, our settlement, our market center. But these people, these barbarians, don't think of it like that at all. We have been here more than 100 years. We have reclaimed land from the desert and built irrigation works and planted fields and built solid homes and put a wall around our town. But they still think of us as visitors, transients. There are old folk alive among them who remember their parents telling them about this oasis as it once was. A well-shaded place by the side of the lake with plenty of grazing even in winter. That is how they still talk about it. Perhaps how they still see it. As though not one spadeful of earth had been turned or one brick laid on top of another. They do not doubt that one of these days we will pack our carts and depart to wherever it was we came from. That our buildings will become homes for mice and lizards, that their beasts will graze on these rich fields we have planted. You smile? Shall I tell you something? Every year, the lake water grows a little more salty. There is a simple explanation, never mind what it is. The barbarians know this fact. At this very moment, they are saying to themselves, be patient. One of these days, their crops will start withering from the salt. They will not be able to feed themselves. They will have to go. That is what they are thinking. That they will outlast us. But we are not going, the young man says quietly. Are you sure? We are not going, therefore they make a mistake. Even if it became necessary to supply the settlement by convoy, we would not go, because these border settlements are the first line of defense of the Empire. The sooner the barbarians understand that, the better. Despite his engaging air, there is a rigidity to his thought that must derive from his military education. I sigh. I have achieved nothing by letting myself go. His worst suspicion is no doubt confirmed, that I am unsound as well as old-fashioned. And do I really, after all, believe what I have been saying? Do I really look forward to the triumph of the barbarian way? Intellectual torpor, slovenliness, tolerance of disease, and death. If we were to disappear, would the barbarians spend their afternoons excavating our ruins? Would they preserve our census rolls and our grain merchants' ledgers in glass cases, or devote themselves to deciphering the script of our love letters? Is my indignation at the course that empire takes anything more than the peevishness of an old man who does not want the ease of his last years on the frontier to be disturbed? I try to turn the conversation to more suitable subjects, to horses, hunting, the weather. But it is late. My young friend wants to leave, and I must settle the reckoning for the evening's entertainment. The children are playing in the snow again. In their midst, with her back to me, is the hooded figure of the girl. At moments, as I struggle towards her, she is obliterated from sight behind the curtain of falling snow. My feet sink so deep that I can barely lift them. Each step takes an age. This is the worst it has snowed in all the dreams. As I labor towards them, the children leave off their play to look at me. They turn their grave, shining faces on me, their white breath drifting from them in puffs. I try to smile and touch them as I pass on my way to the girl, but my features are frozen. The smile will not come. There seems to be a sheet of ice covering my mouth. I raise a hand to tear it off. The hand I find is thickly gloved. The fingers are frozen inside the glove. When I touch the glove to my face, I feel nothing. With ponderous movements, I push my way past the children. Now I begin to see what the girl is doing. She's building a fort of snow, a walled town which I recognize in every detail. The battlements with the four watchtowers, the gate with the porter's hut beside it, the streets and houses, the great square with the barracks compound in one corner. And here is the very spot where I stand. But the square is empty. The whole town is white and mute and empty. I point to the middle of the square. "You must put people there," I want to say. No sound comes from my mouth, in which my tongue lies frozen like a fish. Yet she responds. She sits up on her knees and turns her hooded face towards me. I fear at this last instant that she will be a disappointment, that the face she will present to me will be obtuse, slick, like an internal organ not meant to live in the light. But no, she is herself. Herself as I have never seen her. A smiling child. The light sparkling on her teeth and glancing from her jet-black eyes. "So this is what it is to see," I say to myself. I want to speak to her through my clumsy, frozen muzzle. "How do you do all that fine work with your hands in mittens?" I want to say. She smiles kindly on my mumbling. Then she turns back to her fort in the snow. I emerge from the dream cold and stiff. It is an hour yet to first light. The fire is dead. My scalp feels numb with cold. The girl beside me sleeps huddled in a ball. I get out of bed and with my great cloak wrapped about me start rebuilding the fire. The dream has taken root. Night after night I return to the waste of the snow-swept square, trudging towards the figure at its center, reconfirming each time that the town she is building is empty of life. I ask the girl about her sisters. She has two sisters. The younger, according to her,
very pretty, but scatterbrained.
Would you not like to see your sisters again? I ask. The blunder hangs grotesquely in the air between us. We both smile.
Of course, she says.
I also ask about the period after her imprisonment, when, unknown to me, she lived in this town under my jurisdiction.
People were kind to me when they saw I had been left behind. I used to sleep at the inn for a time, while my feet were getting better. There was a man who took care of me. He has gone now. He kept horses.
She also mentions the man who gave her the boots she was wearing when I first met her. I ask about other men.
Yes, there were other men. I did not have a choice. That was how it had to be.
After this conversation, relations with the common soldiers become more strained. Leaving my apartment for the courthouse in the morning, I passed one of the rare inspection parades. I'm sure that among these men standing to attention with their equipment in bundles at their feet are some who have slept with the girl. It is not that I imagine them sniggering behind their hands. On the contrary, never have I seen them stand more stoically in the frosty wind that whips across the yard. Never has their bearing been more respectful. They would tell me, if they could, I know, that we are all men, that any man can lose his head over a woman. Nevertheless, I try to come home later in the evenings to avoid the line of men at the kitchen door. There is news of the lieutenant's two deserters. A trapper has come upon them, frozen to death in a rough shelter, not far from the road 30 miles east of here. Though the lieutenant is inclined to leave them there. 30 miles there and 30 miles back in this weather, a great deal for men who are no longer men, don't you think? I persuade him to send out a party. They must have the rights, I say. Besides, it is good for the morale of their comrades. They should not think that they too might die in the desert and lie forgotten. What we can do to ease their dread of having to leave this beautiful earth must be done. After all, it is we who lead them into these dangers. So the party leaves, and 2 days later returns with the crooked, ice-hard corpses in a cart. I continue to find it strange that men should desert hundreds of miles from home, and within a day's march of food and warmth. But I pursue the matter no further. Standing by the graveside in the ice-bound cemetery, while the last rites are performed and the deceased's luckier comrades watch bareheaded, I repeat to myself that by insisting on correct treatment of the bones, I am trying to show these young men that death is no annihilation, that we survive as filiations in the memory of those we knew. Yet, is it truly for their benefit alone that I mount the ceremony? Am I not also comforting myself? I offer to take over the chore of writing to the parents to inform them of their respective misfortunes. It comes more easily to an older man, I say.
Wouldn't you like to do something else?
She asks. Her foot rests in my lap. I am abstracted, lost in the rhythm of rubbing and kneading the swollen ankle. Her question takes me by surprise. It is the first time she has spoken so pointedly. I shrug it off, smile, try to slip back into my trance, not far from sleep and reluctant to be diverted. The foot stirs in my grip, comes alive, pokes gently into my groin. I open my eyes to the naked golden body on the bed. She lies with her head cradled in her arms, watching me, in the indirect way I am by now used to, showing off her firm breasts and her sleek belly, brimming with young animal health. Her toes continue to probe, but in this slack old gentleman kneeling before her in his plum dressing gown, they find no response. "Another time," I say, my tongue curling stupidly around the words. As far as I know, this is a lie, but I utter it. "Another time, perhaps." Then I lift her leg aside and stretch out beside her. "Old men have no virtue to protect, so what can I say?" It is a lame joke, poorly expressed, and she does not understand it. She slips open my gown and begins to fondle me. After a while, I push her hand away.
"You visit other girls?" she whispers. "You think I do not know?"
I make a peremptory gesture for her to be quiet.
"Do you also treat them like this?"
she whispers and starts to sob. Though my heart goes out to her, there is nothing I can do. Yet what humiliation for her. She cannot even leave the apartment without tottering and fumbling while she dresses. She is as much a prisoner now as ever before. I pat her hand and sink deeper into gloom. This is the last night we sleep in the same bed. I move a cot into the parlor and sleep there. Physical intimacy between us ends. "For the time being," I say, "until the end of winter, it is better so." She accepts this excuse without a word. When I come home in the evening, she brings me my tea and kneels by the tray to serve me. Then she returns to the kitchen. An hour later, she taps her way up the stairs behind the girl with the dinner tray. We eat together. After the meal, I retire to my study or go out for the evening, resuming my neglected social round. Chess in the homes of friends, cards with the officers at the inn. I also pay one or two visits upstairs at the inn, but with guilty feelings that spoil the pleasure. Always, when I return, the girl is asleep, and I must tiptoe like an erring husband. She adapts without complaint to the new pattern. I tell myself that she submits because of her barbarian upbringing. But what do I know of barbarian upbringings? What I call submission may be nothing but indifference. What does it matter to a beggar, a fatherless child, whether I sleep by myself or not? As long as she has a roof over her head and food in her belly. I have hitherto liked to think that she cannot fail to see me as a man in the grip of a passion, however perverted and obscure that passion may be. That in the bated silences which make up so much of our intercourse, she cannot but feel my gaze pressing in upon her with the weight of a body. I prefer not to dwell on the possibility that what a barbarian upbringing teaches a girl, maybe not to accommodate a man's every whim, including the whim of neglect, but to see sexual passion, whether in horse or goat or man or woman, as a simple fact of life, with the clearest of means and the clearest of ends, so that the confused actions of an aging foreigner who picks her up off the streets and installs her in his apartment so that he can now kiss her feet, now browbeat her, now anoint her with exotic oils, now ignore her, now sleep in her arms all night, now moodily sleep apart, may seem nothing but evidences of impotence, indecisiveness, alienation from his own desires. While I have not ceased to see her as a body maimed, scarred, harmed, She has perhaps by now grown into and become that new deficient body, feeling no more deformed than a cat feels deformed for having claws instead of fingers. I would do well to take these thoughts seriously. More ordinary than I like to think, she may have ways of finding me ordinary, too. 3. The air every morning is full of the beating of wings as the birds fly in from the south, circling above the lake before they settle in the salty fingers of the marshes. In the lulls of the wind, the cacophony of their hooting, quacking, honking, squawking reaches us like the noise of a rival city on the water. Greylag, bean goose, pintail, widgeon, mallard, teal, smew. The arrival of the first of the migrating waterfowl confirms the earlier signs. The ghost of a new warmth on the wind, the grassy translucence of the lake ice. Spring is on its way. One of these days, it will be time to plant. Meanwhile, it is the season for trapping. Before dawn, parties of men leave for the lake to lay their nets. By mid-morning, they are back with huge catches, birds with their necks twisted, slung from poles row upon row by their feet, or crammed alive into wooden cages, screaming with outrage, trampling each other, with sometimes a great silent whooper swan crouched in their midst. Nature's cornucopia. For the next weeks, everyone will eat well. Before I can leave, there are two documents to compose. The first is addressed to the provincial governor. To repair some of the damage wrought by the forays of the Third Bureau, I write, and to restore some of the goodwill that previously existed, I am undertaking a brief visit to the barbarians. I sign and seal the letter. What the second document is to be, I do not yet know. A testament, a memoir, a confession, a history of 30 years on the frontier. All that day I sit in a trance at my desk, staring at the empty white paper, waiting for words to come. A second day passes in the same way. On the third day, I surrender, put the paper back in the drawer, and make preparations to leave. It seems appropriate that a man who does not know what to do with the woman in his bed should not know what to write. To accompany me, I have chosen 3 men. 2 are young conscripts, to whose services on secondment I am entitled. The 3rd is an older man, born in these parts, a hunter and horse trader, whose wages I will pay out of my own pocket. I call them together the afternoon before we leave. I know this is not a good time of year to travel, I tell them. It is a